This call is from a correction facility and is subject to monitoring and recording.
If I've been in here for, I can tell you exactly, 11,945 days, okay? 11,945 days I've been in here, and it hasn't been easy.
100 years? That's, man, I'm a kid. I didn't do anything, you know? And, you know, that was real painful, man. You know, because my life was discarded as if, you know, like I was a piece of trash or something. You know, 100 years, and I had dreams, and I wanted to do things. I wasn't committing crimes, you know? I was a very good young man.
That is what happens in so many cases. The cops have a hunch because they're so smart at the scene. They have a hunch. And then once they act on that hunch, they sort of develop tunnel vision and they take off marching in the wrong direction. And that happens in so many of these wrongful convictions.
They opened the cell door and I walked downstairs, and I actually walked downstairs to be outside. It felt very strange to be, like I said, to be walking without no chakras on my feet. I thought it was a dream, but then again, it wasn't a dream.
This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. That's me. I'm your host. And today we have a very special and unusual episode featuring the one and only John Grisham. John, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here.
So, John, I want to talk to you about this incredible TV series I just watched on Netflix, The Innocent Man, which is based on the book by the same name that you wrote several years ago. And it, for anyone who hasn't watched it, I highly recommend it because it just rocked my world. How did you get involved in this case in the first place, the case of Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz?
Yeah, by the way, thanks for having me. Delighted to be here. Look forward to it. And we've served together on the board of the Innocence Project for probably 10 years now, right?
Yeah, quite a while.
Go way back. I'm on that board because I wrote this book, and I wrote this book because I saw an obituary in the New York Times in December of 2004 for a guy named Ron Williamson, who had just died, obviously, in Oklahoma. And he was my age, my same background, everything. And he had come within 5 days of being executed.
5 days.
In Oklahoma for a crime, for murder he did not commit. And the obituary was fascinating. I mean, I love New York Times obituaries because they
well, they don't write about boring people.
They
right?
really do. Well, and they write about people, these fantastic stories of people you've never heard of. And so I always check out the Times obituaries, but normally they're, you know, people in New York. But Ron's story was it just captured my imagination. And by the time the day was over, I had talked to both of his sisters. One in Tulsa, one in Dallas, and I said, "Hey, I'm gonna write this book," and they said, "Whatever." And one thing led to another. I took off to Oklahoma to start digging, and I had no idea what I was doing. I'm not a journalist. I'm not trained in, you know, that type of work, and I had no idea how to go about telling that a real story.
And this is your only nonfiction book, and it's interesting because there's that classic adage that truth is stranger than fiction. And I think you spent your life as probably the most, you know, a prolific crime novelist maybe ever, right? And coming up with these stories,
yeah,
right?
It, yeah.
It's what you do, dreaming these stories up, literally. But then you bump into this one, and it's beyond anything that you probably could have dreamed up, right? I mean, it's interesting, on the trailer for the Netflix show, I heard you say, if you wrote this, nobody would believe it, right?
That's true with a lot of these innocent stories, as I have come to know over the past dozen years. The facts are so incredible that, first of all, I couldn't dream these things up. I couldn't create these cases because nobody can. They're so remarkably unbelievable. And if you tried to pass this off as in a novel, it's not going to work. A novel has to be plausible. The story can be fiction, or what, you know, it can be science fiction. It can be real, all kinds of different genres of fiction. But it has to be, there has to be a level of plausibility in the story to make it work. Some of the cases we deal with in the innocence world are hard to believe, impossible to believe, almost some of the factual scenarios. In the case in Oklahoma, the Ron Williamson case, the murder itself was easy to believe because it was a horrible crime, and those happen all the time. But what happened after that, and how he was railroaded and convicted in Ada, is just a really remarkable story. And once I started digging, I couldn't stop.
It is a remarkable story in so many ways and on so many different levels. The victim in this case, Debbie Sue Carter, it's a tragic, all these cases are tragic, but in hers, especially as a father, it's just such a horrific circumstance, which speaks to what we're talking about right now, because in her case, Debbie Sue Carter was raped and murdered and tortured. Her killer made sure that she suffered an agonizing death. And what that speaks to is the injustice that's done to everyone, her family, her memory, and everyone else when the wrong person is convicted. But also, what boggles my mind, John, is that in a community, especially a small community like Ada, you would think that even if an authority figure, a police detective or whatever they had, an investigator, was so sort of morally bankrupt that they didn't mind, they didn't lose a wink of sleep convicting an innocent guy. By definition, they were allowing this sick, twisted, psychotic individual who did these terrible, terrible things to Debbie Sue Carter to remain free.
Yeah, and they knew him. They knew him. He was a local boy. He grew up there. He went to high school with Debbie. That's how he got in her apartment. He was the last person seen alive with her when she was alive in a honky-tonk late at night as she was leaving. He was at her car. They were arguing, and she sort of shoved him away and got in the car, and she drove off. And there were witnesses to that, and the police knew it. And a few hours later, he knocked on her apartment, and she let him in because she knew him. She didn't, I don't think she liked him or wanted to be with him, but because they were acquainted, gone to school together, he had the entree, the ability to get into her apartment. And once he did, it was a bad night. But the police did not pursue him, the obvious person, for years, years and years. The murder was unsolved. The cops were thoroughly incompetent. And at the crime scene was horrendous because it was a terrible killing. And he hung around and he wrote messages with her blood on the wall. And he wrote messages on the kitchen table with a bottle of ketchup. And there was just a horrible thing. He stayed there for a long time trying to devise a way to deflect or point the blame at somebody else. And anyway, he was there for a long time. So it was a horrific scene. And these two Keystone cops who are on the scene decide, because it's so violent and it's so bloody, it had to be the work of two people. Okay, that was that decision. Hey, it's got to be two people. We have two defendants here. And that is what happens in so many cases. The cops have a hunch because they're so smart at the scene. They have a hunch. And then once they act on that hunch, they sort of develop tunnel vision and they take off marching in the wrong direction. And that happens in so many of these wrongful convictions.
Yeah, in this case, it's fair to say that this case actually came with instructions, which were ignored.
Yeah.
And they didn't go after the actual killer. I'm forgetting his name.
Glenn Gore.
Right. What a name. Right. Yeah, Glenn Gore.
He's serving a life with no parole in Oklahoma, convicted by the jury in Ada many years too late.
Right. I mean, what an ironic thing that the guy's name would be Glenn Gore. Yeah. Like I said, more instructions as if they were coming from
the
universe.
And he was a local criminal. He had a record. He was a bad dude. The cops knew him for drugs. He was a rough family. I mean, he was well known to the police, and they still didn't pursue him.
They didn't prosecute him until they actually had to, right? It became, you know, it became impossible for them to continue to deflect the blame from him. They sort of, and I've seen this in other cases, they sort of protected him, right? Which is, you know, really hard to process as to, you know, I mean, I grew up like most people, you know, respecting the uniform and, you know, really, I think we all played cops like when we were kids. Sure. And, you know, and I still do. I mean, I'm a person who believes in law and order, and I have a lot of respect for most of the people in the criminal justice system. But when you get bad actors like these guys, the damage that they can inflict is enormous.
I don't know how bad they were. It's obvious how incompetent they were. There was some allegations that these guys, some of the cops there were later convicted of selling drugs, and there was some evidence that Gore was selling drugs, and Gore was selling drugs with the cops, and you know, there was never really a clear path to prove that he was with the cops. Obviously, knew him. Some of the cops were shady. But still, just the sheer incompetence of not investigating. The two lead cops in the case, I don't think had any history with drug dealing or whatever. They were pretty, you know, just a couple of stand-up guys doing their best. But the incompetence of not even considering the last person seen with the victim.
Yeah, who became a witness against Ron, I guess, right? Yeah, he was cleverly, I guess you could say, deflected the blame, as we see not infrequently in these cases where the actual perpetrator becomes a witness for the prosecution, because it's probably the simplest way to, turn the attention away from you and onto somebody else, is make yourself into a witness. And that's exactly what he did. And he got away with it for quite a while. So in this case, you talked about how you were so taken with the story of Ron Williamson. It is a fascinating and sort of terrible story, in that this was a young man who had once had so much promise, right? He was a professional baseball player, drafted by the Oakland A's, and you know, seemed to have his whole life laid out in front of him until he was injured, never made it to the big leagues. And what a strange thing to think about, the cruel sort of capricious or arbitrary nature of this whole thing, that he went from a major league prospect to being on death row. And as you said, coming within 5 days of being executed for a crime that everyone should have known he didn't commit. Right. And of course, he lost his mind in prison and died tragically soon after he was released. And there was another innocent man, Dennis Fritz.
Yeah. Dennis's crime was that he was hanging around with Ron. And Ron became... When Ron was growing up, by the time Ron was in high school, in this section of southeastern Oklahoma, a lot of coaches and scouts believed that he was the next Mickey Mantle. Mickey's from a small town in Oklahoma and a little bit to the north of this, and Mickey was, of course, Mickey. But Ron was in the same mold, big, strong guy, great athlete, solid legs, could hit. And he had a huge ego, small town guy, but he was attracting attention from the scouts, and he had a great high school baseball coach, and they won all these games, and Ron was the man, and he was going to be the next Mickey Mantle. And he got drafted by the A's in 1972 in the first round. They paid him somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 for the bonus, which is not bad back then. It didn't last Ron very long. He went through it pretty fast, lost most of it in a poker game. But he went off to the minor leagues because he was going to make plenty of money and, the injuries. And at some point he begins showing signs of some pretty unstable mental issues, and undiagnosed, later diagnosed as being bipolar, and crashed and burned. And he never got over the fact the baseball career was so important to him as a small kid in Oklahoma, small town boy in Oklahoma. He couldn't accept the fact that he was not gonna be famous. He was not gonna be playing in Yankee Stadium. He was not gonna be Mickey Mantle, and it crashed on him, and he went back to Ada and acted more and more bizarre, different way. He became kind of the town not town drunk, but kind of the town misfit. Unemployed, drinking too much, partying too much, fighting too much. And he was up and down. They tried to get him some help with the local mental health people. They tried their best, but it was not enough. And he was just spiraling down. And he became sort of, it was easy to convict Ron because everybody knew him. He became the town weirdo, the town goofball, the town ne'er-do-well. That was kind of Ron Williamson and people. For a few bucks, he would cut your grass with an old beat-up lawnmower with his shirt off. He'd push his mower up and down the street trying to get a few jobs here and there. That kind of life. Lived almost homeless in somebody's shed in the backyard. And it was a hard fall for him. And it really affected him mentally. And then he lived fairly close to where Debbie Sue Carter was murdered. And the cops early on, and the cops and the prosecutor felt for a long time like Ron was the killer. They just believed. They just, again, tunnel vision. They had a hunch he was their man, and they had no proof. But that didn't stop them. They just kind of manufactured a case against him.
Right. There was no physical evidence connecting them to the crime, obviously, because they weren't there. You know. So
well, there was physical evidence in that this part of what went wrong in the prosecution. There were 17 scalp and pubic hairs taken from the victim's bed crime scene. And at trial, this certified analyst with the Oklahoma Crime Lab testified that the scalp and pubic hair matched Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz. So they had physical proof, junk science, okay? And 10 years later, all 17 hairs were excluded by DNA. There was no DNA available in 1987 when they went to trial. So there was a little bit of physical proof. It was almost all hearsay, jailhouse snitch, bogus testimony by cops, a dream confession, just garbage prosecution. And the prosecutor was pushing hard. He got a jury, a local jury. They wouldn't change venue. And so he ramrodded through a conviction.
Yeah, junk science is an important part of this, too. And, it's interesting because I do want to talk about the death penalty and how this affected you and maybe your views on the death penalty. I don't know what they were leading into this. I don't know what they are now, but I'm interested to hear. But the other thing is with this case, it's just so it's so easy to put yourself in the shoes of the people on that jury, right, who were from the town, right? Mm-hmm. As you said, there was no change of venue. There's a highly publicized case, a terrifying murder in a small community always will generate that kind of media attention and extra pressure on the police.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, one of my goals in doing this show, my main goal in doing this show was to educate people, all of whom, everyone who's listening right now is a potential juror. So are you and I. I don't know who would put me on a jury, but never know.
I would exclude you. As a defense lawyer, I'd kick you off my jury.
Exactly. So, a defense lawyer.
Not a prosecutor. Never. Okay.
So, my hope is that in doing this show and with the now almost 8 million listens that we've had over the course of the first 7 seasons, that we have helped to educate people so that when they are called to serve on a jury in a criminal trial, and when they hold a Ron Williamson or Dennis Fritz's life in their hands, that they will be better educated and more, maybe I want to say more attentive, but maybe a little bit more skeptical.
Right.
I don't want to prevent a rightful conviction from happening. There is the famous saying Ben Franklin said, right? It's better that 100 guilty men go free than that one innocent man should suffer. Benjamin Franklin, kind of a great American. And so I'm interested in your take on that, John. What would you say to anyone who's listening now as having lived through this and researched it and done all this work on this case and all the other things that you've done throughout your career looking into criminal justice matters? How would you advise jurors if they're going next week into a trial? What would you tell them that could help them to make the best decision in the interest of justice?
Well, I would urge anybody to ask themselves the basic question, what is the physical evidence? So let's start with the proof. If it is something like hair analysis or bite mark analysis or boot print analysis or any one of 15 different analyses that have all been proven to be rather shaky. And
tire tracks, sock tire prints, tracks, yeah.
That stuff is all, you know, when the FBI says that 95% of its crack hair analysts got it wrong, 95% from the FBI, you can imagine what's happening out in the States. It's junk science. It's unreliable. So go back to the basic proof, and if a prosecution does not have hard physical evidence, and in most cases they do, okay? Most of these cases are not that close. But as we know in this type of work, there are a lot of cases where the evidence is very flimsy. Number two, I would say if they show up with a jailhouse snitch who is going to testify that while he was in the cell with the defendant 6 months ago, he heard the defendant give a full confession, talked about the case, knew the facts, blah, blah, blah. Don't believe a word of what the snitch is saying, because the snitch has cut a deal with the prosecutor or the police to get some time off. Snitches should not be allowed, period, okay? You know, I would, if there's a false confession, if there's a confession, okay, at least ask some basic questions. Did the defendant recant the following day as soon as he'd get away from the cops? Did he recant? Has he recanted every day since then? And most importantly, does his confession, do the facts match up with the physical evidence? Because in almost every false confession, there's no match. You know, whatever the guy confessed to, he said to get out of the room with the cops, and they are notoriously unreliable. You and I serve on the Innocence Project Board. We have 370 DNA exonerations in the past 25 years. 25% involve false confessions. False confessions are a huge problem. They happen all the time. And if you're a juror, say, okay, the guy confessed in police custody. Was a lawyer present? No, because if the lawyer's there, he wouldn't be confessing. So if the lawyer wasn't there, how long did the interrogation last? Was it 12 hours throughout the night? And when he did confess, what did he say about the facts of the case? Do they match up? It's pretty basic stuff, but not all jurors, you know, are curious enough to ask those questions. Although I got to say, Jason, they are getting more and more skeptical because we are seeing fewer and fewer death verdicts, far fewer death verdicts, far fewer executions, far fewer people on death row because jurors are far more skeptical.
I want to harp on one point that you made, which is that in that FBI, in the investigation that was done into the FBI forensic analyst who testified in hair cases, specifically in cases where hair was the predominant factor leading to the conviction, they found, I think they examined almost 400 cases, and they found that, as you said, over 95% of them, the FBI agents or experts were wrong, but in 100% of the cases in which they were wrong in favor of the prosecution.
Yeah.
So whether they were mistaken, it's hard to believe that they were mistaken in all those cases, right? Because it just statistically doesn't add up that they would every single time make a mistake in favor of the prosecution. Right. So I think, again, we have to really take a hard look at what's being presented in these contexts. Think about what people's motivations are when they're testifying. In the case of the jailhouse snitches, it couldn't be clearer, right? And it's so interesting in our criminal justice system, you know, everyone knows that you can't bribe a witness, right? That's a crime. That's a felony. You know, you can't bribe a witness. But the government has the ability to offer the best bribe that there is. I'm calling it a bribe. It's not called a bribe technically,
it's
right?
It's a deal.
A deal, yeah. They can offer the deal that it's, you know, you can go get out of jail free card, right?
Walk out today.
Yep. Yeah. So, or reduce charges or whatever else they want to do. So, yeah, so that is, I'm really glad you brought that up. Let's talk about the death penalty, because support for the death penalty in America is at an all-time low. And I think it's the first time that more than half of Americans are opposed to the death penalty. How have your views, were you anti-death penalty? Are you anti-death penalty? How have they evolved as a result of dealing with this case?
Well, okay, the numbers are down, but there's still a significant number of people in the majority of states who favor it. if you look at the Death Belt, 36, 38 states, the people who live there and vote there, the majority, and it's 50-50, but in some places it's slightly more who are in favor, still favor the death penalty. So it's popular in a lot of areas. You know, where you live, it's probably not. Other places, it's not. California is the biggest state. They have 600 people on death row, but they know they've executed one person. They're not serious about it, but they still have death row, and it costs them a zillion bucks a year. Growing up in the Deep South as a Southern Baptist, that eye for an eye, that kind of stuff, and it was the Old Testament version of retribution, and we not only believe that, we really sort of advocated the death penalty, and we, no one back then, and I can't ever remember, was ever opposed to the death penalty, and there aren't many of them now. Once I became a lawyer, though, and became into a lot of criminal defense cases, slowly I realized that we have some pretty serious problems in the criminal justice system and some very serious problems with the death penalty, the way it is used. And I just, 25 years ago, I said, this, even if you support the death penalty, you cannot support this death penalty. And the way it's used against minorities, the way it's used, different states use it differently for the same crimes. It's a mess, okay? And so I'm very much opposed to it.
The argument I make to people, and I speak to people who are in favor of the death penalty, is I ask them, what percentage of people, of innocent people, is it okay to execute? So they will say, well, no, you can't execute innocent people. And I go, but you do understand that the system is not, it's far from perfect, but it can never be perfect. Even if everybody in the system did the best job that they possibly could. And we know there are so many different causes. There's some of it's on the defense, right? We have defense lawyers who slept through capital cases. We have defense lawyers who are underpaid. They may be alcoholics. We have cases of death, people sentenced to death where the not too long after their verdict was rendered, their defense attorney was disbarred or even arrested or, found to be, incompetent is too kind of a word. So my question is, even if everybody did the best job that they could, we're still going to make mistakes. So my question for anyone who's listening who's still pro-death penalty would be, how many innocent people is it okay to execute out of 100 or whatever it is? Because if your answer is none, then you can't be in favor of the death penalty, because right. We know we've executed innocent people. Cameron Todd Willingham, there's so many other, Jesse DeFaro, there's so many that come to mind. And I don't want to live in a country that executes innocent people. And America is so far behind the rest of the civilized world in this area. You know, we are among the top five nations in the number of executions, and it's not a good list to be on. The other nations are not nations you'd be proud to be associated with in that way. Western Europe has abolished it. I mean, in the rest of the civilized world, they've for some reason they have a much more evolved.
I think it's us and Pakistan and North Korea, places like that.
China,
yeah.
So it's not a good. It's a bad distinction, and it's something that we can change and we must change. And we're going to keep fighting until we do.
Well, the good thing about it, Jason, the death penalty is dying. It's dying because not because of courageous lawmakers, not because of courageous judges, but because of courageous jurors. And nowadays, the jurors, as for the same reasons we've been discussing. Because of so many high-profile exonerations where these bogus prosecutions were exposed, jurors today are far more skeptical about the abusive tactics used by police and prosecutors to get convictions. That's one factor. Another factor is that most states today are spending more money to train defense lawyers. The defense lawyer in capital cases is far better than it was just a few years ago. So the playing field is kind of level now. And when you go to trial, and in most of your capital cases, the defendant is not only guilty, but very guilty. The proof is there. And so it becomes a question of how do you save this person's life? And what happens now, because the defense lawyers are so much better, they are able to present to the jury the whole picture of this defendant and where he came from and his background and the fact that he probably never had a chance in life. and juror. And once that whole story is exposed in a courtroom, once the jurors hear the whole story, we are seeing it weekly in this country. They're far more willing to go with life with no parole and spare the guy's life. They're more sympathetic.
Right. And then there's a chance to fix it. I just finished reading the remarkable book by Richard Jaffe, who I think is he's a hero of mine. He's, I think, won more successful. He's won more death penalty reversals than any other, or appeals than any other lawyer that I know of. And his book, the subtitle is "Defending the Damned." I'm trying to remember the first, the actual title. It's a wonderful book, and it really speaks to what we're talking about. I mean, you see these cases where it would be apparent to anyone, seemingly, that these people were innocent. Anthony Ray Hinton is a great example of that. You know, and going back to even the Innocent Man case, right? I mean, or the Innocent Man show, because in the show, there were two different cases,
right?
It wasn't just Debbie Sue Carter.
Right. 18 months later, a young lady named Denise Haraway was abducted from a convenience store late at night where she worked in Ada and vanished. And there was no evidence. The crime scene was contaminated. The police did not secure the crime scene. And the cash register was open and she was gone. And some people had seen her leave with a couple of sketchy guys in an old truck, but they couldn't find the body. They couldn't find her. They searched and searched. They couldn't. And this went on for 18 months. And then the police, there were some composite police drawings that were pretty good. And the people called in. They said, that looks like Billy, looks like Joey, looks like Charlie, looks like Tommy, whoever. And so the cops are getting a lot of input from the composite drawings, and they just sort of settled on a guy named Tommy Ward, who was a 20-year-old kid with no record. And they called him in for an interrogation. Didn't tell him why they wanted to talk to him. And so he goes to the police station without any clue that would be his last day of freedom for the rest of his life. And they began interrogating him, and things deteriorated quickly when he realized they were suspicious of him. He had nothing to do with the crime. He was nowhere near the crime scene. He never met the victim. There's not one shred of physical evidence that links him to the crime now or 35 years ago. No evidence at all. And the interrogation went on for a long time, hours and hours, nonstop. And Tommy has said he wanted to talk to a lawyer. That's not clear from the record. There is really no record because it was not recorded. There were cameras in the room, but they didn't record the bad stuff. And Tommy finally snapped. He just snapped, which is not unusual after 8 or 10 years of hours of abusive interrogation. And Tommy said, okay, finally, you know, I'm going to give these guys a story. And it's going to be so outrageous that once they investigate it, they'll realize I'm lying, okay? So he just fed them a big story about grabbing the girl, taking her out, raping her, cutting her throat, burning her body, disposing it over here. And while he was actually doing this, the cops said, well, where did you dispose of her body? He said, well, I threw it down the ditch. So they had a cops in Ada would run to that location and couldn't find the body. So they called back to the police station and said, we can't find the body. So the cops say, Tom, the body's not there. Where's the body? And they say, oh, you'd make up some other. Well, the body's over in the warehouse, you know, whatever. So the cops would go over there. Well, it wasn't there. Well, the cops, it's in the bottom of a silo. They'd go, this goes on all night long. These stupid cops are running around Ada trying to find the body because Tommy's making stuff up. Okay, Tommy's just making stuff up because he's half crazed. Okay, and finally, they said, "Okay, enough of that. Let's have the confession." And after about 15 hours, they turned the machine on, and they recorded Tommy. And you see this in the Netflix episode where he's sitting there punch drunk, out of his mind, and he can't get the facts straight. The cops have fed him the facts, and he keeps making mistakes. And so the cops correct him on tape. You see this in the show.
I saw it.
And it's, I mean, that's been reviewed by some experts experts in false confessions who just shake their head at how bad the false confession is. I mean, as far as false confessions go, it's not even, it's horrible. Anyway, they never found the body, okay? But they had a confession. So they go to trial without the body. And Tommy's found guilty of capital murder, rape and capital murder, with no body, okay? He goes off to death row in Oklahoma. 6 months later, a hunter stumbled across a body in a shallow grave a few miles from Ada in a remote section of the county. And they do the dental exams, and it's Dee's Haraway. And she'd been shot once in the back of the head, and that was the cause of death. Not burnt, not stabbed, not, you know, whatever. And in most jurisdictions, in most places in the country, once the body was found and once the people realized it had nothing even remotely familiar with the confession, it's time to call time out and rethink things. But not in Ada.
So, yeah, I mean, when I think about this case, and it's been, you know, several weeks since I watched the show, but I think back on it and I go, how in this country could Tommy Ward and Carl Fontenot be convicted of a stabbing that was actually a shooting, right? I mean, it wasn't even the right crime. Yeah. And furthermore, in their testimony, they said that they were with another guy,
yeah,
right? And who we know wasn't there because right. his alibi was airtight.
Right.
So everything was wrong with this case.
Everything was wrong, yeah.
And the tragedy is, and the human side of this, which of course, you know, affects me and I think anyone who's got empathy for their fellow man or humans, you know, you see Tommy particularly in the show, who's been in prison now for about 33 years or 34 years. Yeah. It was a 94 case. And he comes across as just sort of a big bear of a man, but kind of like a gentle giant, you know, and just sort of a very kind, he's got a kind way yeah. about him. You know, he's, you know.
He's a sweet guy. He was a sweet boy. I mean, he grew up in a church, big family, all devout churchgoers. He was, you know, 20 years old. He was a little bit on the wild side for a while, but now after 34 years in prison, he's earned his GED, he's earned his degree, he's earned several Bible study awards through the mail. He teaches several Bible study groups. He's sort of like the official chaplain. This guy has a perfect prison record, and he's never spilled a cup of coffee in prison. He's a wonderful human being who sort of accepted his fate in life, that this is just, you know, for some reason I've been dealt this hand, and I'll survive it. And, you know, but he's lost his childhood. He's lost the chance to marry, have a family. He worries about his mother, who's 90 and obviously failing, and he would love to see her, but it's a huge tragedy. And the tragedy, as we talk about, Jason, so many times, is you get frustrated at the authorities and the bogus conviction and the, you know, the cops and all the horrible things they did. But the real killer, you know, was still out there, is still out there. We have a few suspects in mind, but these people have not been brought to justice. 34 years later, they still have never been brought to justice because the cops blew the case. And that's what happens with wrongful convictions. It's another reason to be so frustrated by them, is the real rapist and the real murderers are left free to roam, and they almost always repeat their crimes.
They almost always do. And of course, there's another victim in this case. And when I say victim, I mean another innocent man who was convicted, which is Carl Fontenot, who was a guy who was you know, very clearly, you know, slow. He was he was a guy who had, you know, developmental issues of some sort. I'm not a psychologist, but you know, you can watch that tape and you watching that show. I want to jump through the screen and stop the process because you're sitting there watching. It kind of reminds me of Making a Murderer when they're interviewing Brendan Dassey, right? Because he just doesn't understand what's going on.
Right.
And he is so easily led like a lamb to the slaughter, right? And we know that in false confession cases, it's so much, well, obviously it's easier to get someone who's of limited mental acuity, but also people who are most likely to falsely confess are people who are teenagers. And ironically, people in the military, and you had that, of course, here with a case that you were deeply involved with the Norfolk Four,
right.
Because they are used to, and this is counterintuitive, but they, because you know, I think most of us think that a military guy would be able to stand up for himself, but they're used to obeying authority figures and orders. So they can,
they respect authority figures and they kind of want to do something to help the authority figures with their job. And a lot of times you'll see people who are vulnerable step way out of line to kind of help the cops out. And that's why a lot of interrogations, the police are quick to say, okay, would you agree to a polygraph? Well, innocent people jump at the chance to do a polygraph to prove themselves. Guilty people never do, okay? But innocent guys in interrogation, they go, oh, yeah, I'll take a polygraph. Which is fatal, okay? Because what the cops are allowed to do is give the polygraph, a true, real polygraph, okay? And usually the defendant passes the polygraph, and the cops are allowed to then lie about it. They walk back in the room with the graph paper. They throw it in the guy's face and say, you flunked the polygraph. Now we have proof you're lying. We can use this in court. You're getting the death penalty. And just bam, 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 and it's all a lie. But our Supreme Court said that's okay.
Right. And America is, I don't think alone in this, but is an outlier in this, in that police are allowed to lie during the interrogation
repeatedly,
process. Yes.
Repeatedly. They can lie about any lie they want to tell.
Exactly.
Any lie they want to tell during interrogation, they can do it with impunity.
Right. So when you're sitting there going, well, I would never confess to a crime. But then they bring you in, they go, John, listen, man, we got your fingerprints on the murder weapon.
Yeah.
We got your DNA on the body. We just tested. We did a quick test. We did an instant test, whatever they say, right?
And your two buddies next door in separate rooms have both said, told us the truth. They've said you pulled the trigger. We know you did it. Okay. These guys are testifying against you. You look at the death penalty and you're toast, man. But if you'll trust us and go along with it, we know the judge, we know the prosecutors, you know, we can help you cut a deal, but to save your skin, you better tell us now, and we'll help you out.
Right. There's a movie that actually is out now called False Confessions that actually I'm in it because they taped an episode of the podcast. But
you're in a movie, Jason?
Yeah. And you know, that may
I didn't
be
know
why,
you had that kind of time.
That may be why it hasn't become a hit just yet, but it will. But anyway, but no, it's a really good movie, and in it you see that what they do is they sort of close this circle where they finally come to you and go, listen, now we know that we've got all this evidence against you, and we know that the other guy said you did it. So you can either be a perpetrator or a witness. Which one do you want to be? And then so that speaks to another thing that I wanted to ask for your take on as someone who's got this vast experience chronicling, writing about, participating in so many different aspects of the criminal justice system. Let's say someone's listening now and they or a family member gets picked up for something they didn't do. What's your advice? What's the do's and don'ts when you get first picked up? And remember, of course, you know, as you touched on, many people get picked up not realizing that they're a suspect and they're not told they're a suspect. Just come to the police station, we want to ask you a few questions about something. What would you advise?
You're assuming it's a serious crime that they are being questioned about. I would, I'm a lawyer, okay? So I would say, you know, I'll be there with my lawyer. I'll be there with you can put them off. I'll be there tomorrow at whatever time with my lawyer. Okay. That's the way I would start it. Most folks don't think like that because, you know, the innocent people don't really worry about it. It's no big deal. They want to cooperate with the cops. They want to help the cops solve the crime. So they walk into this and oftentimes get burned. But I would never. Listen, I've had in the past 20 years, I've had two on two separate occasions, I've had the doorbell rings. I go to the door. It's the FBI agent. And they have the badge, FBI. I always kind of laugh. You know, something you see on television. I've done nothing wrong. And both times it was sort of an ancillary issue to a bigger case somewhere that I never got involved in. And the guy said, both guys said, I'd like to ask you some questions. And I said, okay, what's it about? And before they come in the house, okay, tell me what you're talking about. And so they would give me some, you know, they're kind of pushy. They give me some of the background. And both times I said, okay, I'll be happy to talk to you. Let me call my lawyer. Where's your office? I'll be there tomorrow with my attorney, and we'll have a conversation. And they don't like that, but that's as far as they can go. Because if you were to inadvertently tell an FBI agent something that's not really true, that's a federal crime, okay? You can go to prison. Martha Stewart went to jail for that, okay? That happens. Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer. That's happening now. You see it all the time. Now, those folks are under investigation. But if a FBI agent or a cop stopped me on the street and said, hey, can we ask you a couple of questions? Can I ask you some questions? I would say, what's it about? Whatever crime, whatever situation, whatever inquiry. Yeah, I'll talk to you. Yeah, tell me when and where, and I'll have my lawyer there.
Right. That's something I talk about on the show is that, you know, I advise people. I mean, everybody wants to help in solving a crime. If you're a witness to a crime, I don't want to tell you not to, we all want safe streets. We all want a safe society. But, you know, the minute there's an inflection point at which, you know, and Marty Tankleff's a great example of this too, right? I mean, at some point it became clear that they weren't interviewing him as they said they were about his business partner or anything like that, about the father's business partner, they were looking at him as a suspect. And at that point, the only words he should have said, and I wish I could go back in time and tell him this, are, I want a lawyer. And that's it. And then the questioning stops. It took way too long for that to happen. And they were able to extract at least some form of a false confession out of him. And the next thing you know, it took 17 and a half years to overturn that conviction. And it's a tragedy. And, you know, we both know Marty and how much we think of him. I mean, what a beautiful, amazing, amazing guy. And what a terrible fate to lose both parents and then be blamed for it. And meanwhile, the real perpetrator, who it seems abundantly clear who it is, remains free and is enjoying his retirement in Florida right now. So, you know, there's that. And it just doesn't add up at all. So
I've raised two kids. They're adults now, but when they were teenagers, I'm a former criminal defense lawyer. And I've always told my kids and my wife, if you get pulled over and the cop says, can I search your car? The answer is no. I don't care what I don't care where you are. The answer is no. If they show up at the door, yeah. If you have a search warrant, if they come to your house and knock on the door and want to search, sure, show me a search warrant. If they want to interrogate you, yeah, I'd be happy to talk, but let me get my lawyer involved. You know, you don't ever trust. Have a healthy distrust for people who show up and want to talk or search.
Well, that's good advice. I mean, and again, if we can help by virtue of you being on the show, you know, one person avoid this horrible fate that Ron Williamson, Dennis Fritz, Carl Fontenot, and Tommy Ward, all in a small town of. So let's think about that too, right? Because I'm a statistical guy. You have this small little speck of a town, Ada, Oklahoma. You have four wrongful convictions inside the space of 2 years.
Well, actually, you had six in the span of 5 years. And four of the six have been exonerated by DNA. Ron and Dennis, and then Perry Lott and Calvin Lee Scott were served 20 and 30 years for rapes they didn't commit. And then that's four. Then Tommy and Carl, that's six. They're still locked up. They have not been exonerated, and you know I'm not sure they're going to be.
But we know they're innocent. And so yeah. So I'm just extrapolating a little bit.
Six in 5 years.
In Ada, Oklahoma.
Same police, same cops, same prosecutor, same DA's office, same everything. Six wrongful convictions in 5 years.
Right. And social scientists, the studies that have been done, obviously it's no one can know for sure. We'll never know for sure, but estimate that around 5% of the people in prison in America are innocent. So that number is pretty close to 100,000 people, innocent people in
prison.
Yeah,
it's 2 million behind bars, which is the largest incarceration rate in the world, the civilized world. So you have 2 million behind bars, and You know, some people say 5% is low. That's still 100,000 people. But there, I was not aware of that until I wrote the book and I realized how many innocent people are in prison. And there are a lot of them.
So, yeah, and I encourage anyone who knows someone who is innocent in prison to get out there and make as much noise as you can, bring as much attention, talk about it. You never know, even if you're talking about it in a diner, there might be somebody sitting at the next table that might be a, you know, somebody of influence. Talk to a journalist, write letters. I mean, we have to bring as much attention to these cases as we can, and that's what we're here for. So, John, we have a tradition on Wrongful Conviction, which is at the end of each episode, and this is my favorite part of the episode. I think it's Juan, our producer, I think it's his favorite part of the episode, and it's our audience's favorite part. This is the part where I stop talking, and I thank
that's
you.
That's got to be a good thing.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, you can't insult me when I insult them. This is the M&M defense I'm using, right, where you put all this stuff out there first. So, as he did in the famous rap battle in 8 Mile. But so, first of all, I want to thank you for being here on Wrongful Conviction. And I want to turn the mic over to you for final thoughts.
Final thoughts. Well, first of all, selfishly, I encourage you to watch The Innocent Man, the Netflix series, which I had nothing to do with, although I'm the executive producer, which means I did nothing. Every show now has 14 executive producers, and I still don't know what one does. But I was involved in it a little bit. But from a storytelling point of view, it's a fantastic story, very well done by somebody else. I wrote the book, you know, years ago, and got all the attention I needed for that. But the Netflix is a series is compelling and it's informative, and it lays out so many reasons for wrongful convictions.
Well, thank you again for being here, and you've been listening to an extra special episode of Wrongful Conviction with the one and only John Grisham. John, thanks again.
My pleasure.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.